The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation.
Hey, Quincy Parker, how the hell are you?
I am fantabulous.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. I have not heard that spin in a while.
Yes, it is a strange and wonderful day wherein my... I don't know how to say this, but in short, in brief.
En bref,
yes, absolutely. Everything's coming up roses in my life. I mean, it's not as if I don't have to work. I mean, I still got to work my butt off, but the trend overall is very positive. And I am delighted by this.
Well, super good. I'm happy for you, sir.
Well, I mean, I'm happy for me too. I think I'm going to leave that there for the time being.
Yeah. Cool.
Because I do not wish to. I believe that the term is jinx it. But I must ask how you, Matthew, are doing. It's been quite a while since we had a public conversation in this manner. So I would like to know how you are, how you have been. Is all well?
All is well. All is well. Weirdly, I find myself in Nassau. Yet we are recording this not in person. Yesterday, I found occasion to rescue a kitten running in the street. And this morning I found out that now constitutes as a workout, as I am stiff everywhere. But overall, yeah, not too bad.
Matthew, are you saying that running after a kitten made you sore?
That is what I attempted to communicate, yes. I mean, it was also a bunch of... it was like a HIIT workout. You know, there's a lot of explosive activity. Bending down, jumping onto the ground, you know, flat to try and grab... cat from under a car. It kept running, you know, so it's, you know, high intensity. I
mean, obviously, if you look at it from the cat's perspective, you could see why it would run.
Oh yeah,
this great big being from out of nowhere is all of a sudden trying to
catch. the idiot was running anyway, so that this was his main issue. If it had just stayed scared in the bush somewhere, it would have been safe from that part of things. I don't know if his mother just took too long or something disturbed it while it was waiting on his mom or whatever. But, you know, running in the street, the dual carriageway at the light, not the best idea. And then, of course, it tried to hide up in the engine compartment. That got too hot. So, you know, it's back and forth. And this poor lady, God bless her soul, that she stayed still and let me try and capture this cat. Because, you know, there are some more heartless behemoths out there. So that cat was very lucky. But yeah, I am sore, sir.
So, okay. in another forum, we're going to have to pursue that a little more, because I have my own story to tell you about having a chondritis in my right side of my chest, which I may have gotten by sleeping in a bad position. So we could chop that up, you know, another time. But I want to get to your thoughts about the conversation we're about to hear. You had a chance to listen to what Therese Turner Jones had to say. Oh, so sorry. Let me do this properly. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society. My name is K. Quincy Parker.
Sorry.
And no, here I pause for...
No long list of adjectives. You took me off guard. And I am Matthew B. Kelly.
And today, we can address that later. And today, we are excited to chat with you. On the last pod, I played part of my conversation with Therese Turner Jones, international economist and woman of mystery. And she and I talked about the presentation of the budget by the Prime Minister in the House of Assembly. Both of us had a chance to kind of glance through the budget heads, which is where the details are. And so it's kind of an introductory conversation, but there were some bits of the conversation that were a little too long to be included in the last pod. So I've cut those out, and we'll hear those parts of the conversation today. But before we get to that, I kind of want to, well, first of all, Matthew, what are you drinking? And second of all, you know, did you have any like specific responses to anything that Therese or I would have said during the conversation that you heard?
Yeah, I mean, I do have some, well, I have some comments. So I'm happy to get into those. Unfortunately, I do not have a beverage in front of me. I guess that's the one thing that's not going super well for me right now, because I really wish that I did. It's that kind of day, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of sticky icky. But not so hot as to make one seek naught but mineral water.
So I am going to do something that I should not do. This is a first for the Sunday Scotch Society.
I am not
going to drink the scotch that I have, because what I have today is a special treat for me. And I want to share it with you. It is a bottle of the Weller Special Reserve. Now, Weller is a standard in the bourbon world. It is the original wheated bourbon. You know, bourbon is all about corn and rye. Weller introduced a significant wheat component into their mash, which gives Weller whiskeys and other wheated whiskeys, but it started with Weller, it gives them a particular kind of flavor profile. And this bottle was brought for me from foreign by a friend, and I was instructed that I had to share this bottle, or at least a drink from this bottle, with you on the show. So I was gonna sip that today, but since you don't have a drink, we're gonna skip that part of the show today and just have a conversation, listen to what Therese and I talked about, and then get to it from there. Wow, I don't
dare I think that this constitutes having a double the next time we meet.
I mean, it depends on what time of day it is. It depends
this is true.
On what kind of mood you're in.
Various things, but
I'm all about it. Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. Okay. I am looking forward to that. In your continuing quest to win me over to bourbons. Because the more
West per se, but it bourbons are, I mean, they're their own wing in the whiskey room. You know what I mean? And if you don't like that wing, then you don't like that wing. But
you're showing me how to choose. That's what it is. So maybe, you know, maybe I don't like in general, but these here, I mean, you know, maybe there wasn't one that you've shared with me so far that I absolutely fell in love with, put in the category of, I don't generally like bourbons, but so yeah, I'm happy to call it a quest, even if you don't see it that way, because it just makes me feel, I don't know, as if I didn't get my initial bourbon indifference wrong. So it's a totally me thing. I get it. Fine. But yeah.
I mean, did I say that? I feel like you are either misconstruing what I said or deliberately misrepresenting me for whatever strange reason I cannot understand.
No, I think we're miscommunicating here. I'm saying that I want to continue thinking of it as a quest because that makes me feel better and sort of helps my subconscious feel as if, oh, I didn't get my initial indifference to bourbons wrong.
Okay.
It eases my conscience is what I'm saying.
Okay, fair enough. All right, so here's what I'll do then. Let's rearrange how we were going to do things. And let's go ahead and play the conversation with Therese now. And then you and I can talk about it for a couple of minutes afterwards.
Okie dokie.
Ladies and gentlemen, here's my conversation with Therese Turner-Jones. We were talking about the budget presented by the Davis administration 2 weeks ago. And these are just initial thoughts in what I expect to be a much longer, a much more detail-oriented conversation over the next couple of months, I'm sure. Not necessarily in this forum, but I thought it was appropriate for the Sunday Scotch Society as well. So here's the clip.
The interesting parts on the duty exemptions, for example, on things like appliances that are high energy efficient, I think that's in and of itself, that's a good thing. It raises consciousness among Bahamians about energy efficiency and the fact that it's important overall that the government begin to meet its commitments under the Paris Agreement to get to net zero. I think the year in question for the Bahamas is something like 2050, which is a long way off, but it's a target anyway. So, you know, there's a lot in there, and there's a lot around policy reform in the budget. But I think I would have liked, just because I'm this way, it's not necessarily that everybody needs to be this way, but I would have liked to have seen more clarity on the policies and then, you know, talk about, okay, here are the numbers. Because, you know, literally we elect people to make policies. They are lawmakers, and so that means they change the law to make our lives better. That's what they're there for. So you want to see the policies that are really going to improve the lives of Bahamians over time. And here, I think it could have been clearer to say, you know, in our strategy towards energy reform includes these elements. We're going to reduce our fossil fuel dependence by X, by this particular time. We didn't see that. We just have a long-term date out there, but it's not really clear how the energy reform that's been put in place up to now, how that's actually materializing. I think most Bahamians know that BPL is their sole electricity provider. Some of us who can afford it have solar panels. Some of us actually off the grid. I'm not one of those people yet, so I'm still getting a PPL bill. But I think many people are trying to mitigate against rising electricity costs, because in this country, we see electricity costs going up most of the time and not coming down. So I, as a consumer, I'm definitely looking forward to when these other sources of energy are going to come on stream so that we can lower electricity costs. I think every consumer in this country and every business person in this country knows that our electricity costs are among the highest in the world. And that prevents Bahamians who want to do things like go into manufacturing, because electricity costs are so high. It's very, very difficult to turn a profit if you are using a lot of energy to produce those goods. So that's been a negative on us for a long time. Even the hotels, 25% of hotel costs are electricity costs. So that just gives you scale of, oh my goodness, if we could improve that by either becoming more reliant on renewable energy, which now we can't, the price of solar panels and so on, photovoltaics are coming down. So imagine if more companies, anybody who wanted to produce something, if they can switch over from fossil fuels away from BPL, that would, by definition, to generate their own energy that way, then you can lower your costs. But I think we're still a far way off from that. Unlike some other countries in this region, I think Barbados has done a good job over the years of promoting renewable energy. I first lived in Barbados in 2007 to 2010 when I headed an IMF organization in Barbados. And at that time, it struck me that, there are a lot of solar water heaters on just about every house. And then I understood that there was a policy. If you were building a new house in Barbados, and this is still the policy, you had to put a solar water heater on your house. So when you've got policies like that, over time, behavior starts to change. And then the homeowner, and in Barbados, they actually manufacture these solar water heaters. So it's not that complicated. If Barbados can do it, we can do it. So policy really drives behavioral change, and that's what we need on the renewable energy front. And I think I would have wanted to see more along those lines.
I wanna push back a little bit on something, mm-hmm. though. Mm-hmm. If Barbados can do it, we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how true that is, because we haven't really invested in manufacturing.
I'm just being strictly on, as an economist, I'm talking about the size of the economy, the size of labor force. Bahamas is actually bigger. We're 400,000, they're about 300,000. Mm-hmm. They have virtually the same sort of natural endowments that we have. Sun, sand, and sea, tourism is the main industry, and then financial services, very similar. Their labor force, to me, pretty similar to Bahamian labor force in that while the Barbadians tout that they are 99% literate throughout their labor force or even population, I question that, having lived there for 3 years before, and then most recently almost 2 years. I see the same issues with the labor force in Barbados that I see in the Bahamas, meaning still very little use of technology to augment the productivity of labor, no training of workers in a lot of cases across all their sectors, just like here. I think the Bahamian government, let me put it, of late seems to be investing more in art, vocational training and so on. Barbados is also getting there. They've done some educational reform measures lately, and they're putting a lot of emphasis on vocational training as well. So I say it in terms of endowment, not necessarily, that they manufacture more than we do. Maybe they do, but not to a significant extent. So the same sorts of things, mattresses, they've got the solar panels. We don't have that. They do, they've got a bit of a textile industry there. we have a little bit of a textile industry here. It's not, you know, I wouldn't call Barbados a country where there's a lot of manufacturing going on. Still very small, just like here. Mm-hmm.
I was asking whether or not it's apples to oranges or is it apples to apples?
No, it's pretty much apples to apples. It's whether how big is your apple versus mine. I think we're both apples. My apple may be a bit bigger on certain sectors. And I think the Bahamas tourism apple, for example, keep with this metaphor. I think our apple may be bigger there than theirs. Numbers wise. Mm-hmm. They have very many more visitors coming in. They have fewer. They are not so dependent on cruise travelers.
I was about to say, they probably get more bang for the buck, though.
They are getting more bang for the buck. On average, their stayovers are longer, mostly because, although I have to correct myself, even mid-sentence, Barbados, only recently, more Americans are starting to go to Barbados than before. It used to be predominantly British or European, Canadian, whereas Bahamas was always more US-based, you know, some European visitors, some UK visitors. And I think that's changing in Barbados. And I would say it's actually changing for the better. And I'm going to explain why. I think whether we like it or not, American visitors sort of demand more in terms of service and quality. And just, I'm also not being prejudicial to British or European visitors, because I think as I'm going with this story, I could run myself up on brakes. But I think Americans are much more exposed to of certain quality of service, restaurants, food, this kind of thing. Whereas I think the part of the European market and the British market that Barbadians get, I don't want to say it's, it may be of a lower income quality than say the average American visitor to the Bahamas. So there's a little bit difference in terms of the demographics. I think the tourism people will probably have more to say on this, but there's something there about the demographics of their visitor versus our visitors. But in Barbados, what I would say in their favor, and this is something that I absolutely enjoyed about the country, is that it's a country where there's less reliance on bells and whistles for average things, meaning Barbados, all beaches in Barbados are freely accessible to the public. It doesn't matter where it is, doesn't matter if it's a fancy strip of Sandy Lane property on the West Coast, or whether it's their main strip, Bay Street in town. All the beaches are accessible to the public. And the place is extremely clean, and you don't get a lot of,
bluntly, this is the yes. Sunday Star Society. Just be blunt, that's fine.
It appeals more to the average person. Like, you don't, everyone is welcome everywhere in Barbados. You don't get a sense that there's a lot of, at least as far as use of public facilities go, they are definitely catering to everyone. So the beaches all have bathrooms and running water, and people use it for recreation, in the morning when you, and just like here, right? You go to Montague Beach in the morning, you see lots of people in the sea and so on. But there are facilities, people can shower after, wash the sand off their feet, get back in their car, go home. But there is a lot of appreciation for nature in Barbados that sometimes I think Bahamians, maybe we take, again, back to our first start of the conversation, maybe we take it too much for granted. But cleanliness of beaches, the lack of litter, I think all those things make it a lot more appealing to be walking around in that country. It feels safer to walk around. They don't have, just like us, they don't have proper sidewalks either in some places. But they have invested, for example, in a boardwalk against the South Coast, which is, main coast where the, let's say, Bay Street is in Barbados. And then on the West Coast, there's also a boardwalk there. So they have definitely done some improvements to their coastal zone areas, and part of it is to shore up against, you know, mitigating against disasters. But it turned out to be also helpful for average Barbadians to exercise in the morning, evening, and so on. And it makes for a really nice place to live in that way.
I agree. You talk about boardwalks, and this brings me back to something that I wanted to talk to somebody else about. This idea of, and this is a diversion from the budget, but it is, I think, relevant in this context. The concept of heads of agreements, and the fact that just like the surplus, a heads of agreement is a projection, right? It just means that
we're sitting down. We're talking about
that. We are going to agree on a thing.
Correct.
Right. We have not signed anything yet. Ain't nothing substantial happened yet.
Right.
But we agree that this is the direction we're going to go.
Right. And, but I mean, again.
But before you go, Therese, I remember in the heads of agreement for the point, there was a boardwalk that was supposed to be built from the point all the way to Arawak Key.
That never happened.
The point has been in operation since 2015.
Wow. Yeah.
And it is now 2025.
Yeah.
And there is no boardwalk.
Yeah. So and what I would say to that is heads should roll, right? So the thing is, I think the population should not allow our officials to get off the hook on substantive things like that. So here is where transparency is important. And I didn't know this was in the heads of agreement. Thank you for sharing that with me. First time I'm hearing that, but then, you know, I haven't been living in the Bahamas now for over 30 years, even though I come back and forth a lot. And now I'm here for maybe for a good while.
Therese, if you haven't been in the country, people who are in the country don't remember that.
Right. But what I'm saying to you is that's why it's important to have civil society organizations who will remind, and whether they're environmental organizations or what. And, you know, I think we just need a healthy dose of democracy with a small d, which means that, you know, in healthy societies, people can talk about issues without it being labeled one political color or the other. And
for sure.
I think a healthy society is where debates and talking about issues that are of interest to every single citizen or person living in the country. I don't have to be a citizen to want to have, you know, if I'm living here because I'm a migrant worker or I'm working in whatever sector, I'd like to be able to enjoy walking down the street on a sidewalk where I don't have to keep looking down because I may break my ankle on the sidewalk. And going, I mean, in Bay Street, Parliament Street, I can't talk enough about Parliament Street and the lack of a proper sidewalk there. And I'm hoping that the 90 million, I think that's the amount that was in the budget, signed with the IDB to do work on drainage and sidewalks. To me, that was exciting. That was the most exciting thing I found in the budget, by the way, that we will get some proper sidewalks. And when it rains, people who have to walk on the street aren't getting splashed because the water is draining properly and we're not wetting up the pedestrians. So those things to me speak to being, you know, starting to care about citizens. What I have observed about previous budgets and about orientation in general is that we cater a lot to our export sector. And by that, I mean, everything is about tourism. Making sure the tourist is happy, making sure our hoteliers are satisfied, and so on. But that's not the real purpose of our government and our administrators, to make sure that every Bahamian feels like they really are part of the society and their needs are being met first. Right. Mm-hmm. So in order for the tourism sector to be healthy, happy, well looked after with good productive workers, starts with every Bahamian having access to good education, good training opportunities, living wage and beyond, and you know, services that are going to help them be their best selves when they present themselves in the tourism sector or whatever sector it is that we're
we need to work in.
And that's to me, that's where we start. We start with, okay, and again, if I were to say what's lacking in this particular narrative in the budget is a vision for where we're going, right? So the vision, I mean, all right, it did tackle, we started talking about the inflation, it talks about modernization, it talks about protecting our natural environment, so the debt to nature swap and so on. Let's now tell a story. So where are we going with this? And, you know, if you ask a Bahamian child today, like a 11-year-old, what is their dream? Like, you need to start tapping into what the dreams are of Bahamians to then figure out, okay, I need to create a vision around those dreams so that we can set out a plan to realize those in whatever many years we want to do it. And everyone in the country ought to be able to feel something that's in this budget that they can relate to and that it makes sense. And I think to be fair, this budget tries to do something for almost everyone, right? So we saw, again, I talked about the inflationary impact things that they put in there. If you are a small business, I mean, there was stuff targeted to that. The protection of the environment and so on. So I think they tried, but I
don't know if they really tried, though.
You don't know if they really tried?
I don't really know if they did. The PM in his budget communication talked a lot about, well, in the early part of the communication, he talked about advocacy for Bahamians, right? Advocacy for the hiring and promotion of Bahamians and lowering the barriers or removing the barriers that are standing in Bahamians' ways. And he talked about the fact that that Bahamians deserve the education, training, and opportunities that match their talent and ambition. Mm-hmm. And he said that the budget builds on gains in education and training with quote-unquote substantial new and historic investments in our people.
And that's not well elaborated. What are they?
I was going to say that's not what I saw. In the budget. What I saw in the budget communication was an attempt at sort of convincing people that we are moving in a certain direction that is not necessarily reflected in the reality that people are experiencing. And that's fine because, I mean, I guess a budget is supposed to be an aspirational document. Correct. Budget communication is supposed to be aspirational. I get that. And I appreciate that. But by the same token, the facts need to be they need to be a part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And I feel conflicted because so Gowan Bo had a very interesting response to the budget, and one of the things that I want to pick up on is to make a projection is one thing, but projections usually are based, and you're the expert here, so you can you can tell me if I'm right on this, but my sense is that projections for the future are based on performance in the past, right? And
well, you start the projections with an outturn. So,
right.
And it should be real hard data. So,
right.
I only just got the estimates, the 300 pages of the.
No. And that's why numbers. I said this is an introductory conversation.
I know. What I'm saying is typically the technicians would, you know, there are formulas for the projections. And yes, you're going to start with last year's outturn, and then you're going to, you know, multiply that by some coefficient based on what you think is going to happen to GDP, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If you expect GDP to grow by 1.8, that would be kind of like a the lowest number you're going to start with in terms of, okay, if GDP is going to grow by 1.8, we take this year's revenue and you multiply it by 1.8, we can reach some higher number or by
whatever that's not right. Next
year, right?
Yeah.
But where I think you are headed with this, maybe, and this is where transparency can help, is if the government would share their assumptions. Normally, when you do economic forecasts, you always have a cover page with what we call the metadata, right? So here's where we start. GDP is X, inflation is Y, blah, 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 blah. These are the baseline numbers. And then here is, so anyone should be able to replicate these estimates if they knew what that metadata was, right? But let's trust that the finance officials, they're not fudging numbers. Somebody asked a question on the show.
You could trust that if you want to, Reese Turner Jones, but I don't.
I know. No. What I'm saying is, the response I gave to the caller in the conversation was that it wouldn't make sense for any finance official worth their 2 cents to be fudging numbers, because they're going to be analyzed by first the IMF when they have the next article for consultation. And I'm sure a lot of the data that we see in this budget, those estimates, if we go and look at the article for presentation that came out from the fund, I think it was in January of this year or February of this year, the report was published, you're going to see some of those same numbers, because where the government really has to, they work together on those estimates.
For sure.
And whatever gets published is what the government, it's the best guess, right? So we all know it's still estimates, meaning until you have the final number of VAT intake for April, you can't say what the total revenue was until the last day of April. And then when that all those accruals come in, maybe people pay late and you fix the numbers. So there are revisions all the time. What I'm saying is, it would be quite a lot of folly for them to absolutely try to make a story that they cannot reach, because at the end it's going to be a huge blowback. You've got the IMF coming back again. You've got credit rating agencies doing their due diligence. You've got the IDB also doing the same thing. The World Bank, everybody. So you know, it's not really. I would like to dispel that one. I think on the issue of projections, it's just a caveat. You know, it just remind people it is a forecast. It's not actual. We're not there yet.
Exactly.
We're not there yet. So I would say let's not count our chickens before they hatch. That's the, I think, expression everybody understands. You can't be saying, yeah, we're going to get surplus when, well, we can project a surplus. So, but I must say a lot was made of the fact that this is an historic moment, it's a balanced budget, and so on. And so I think a year from now, we are going to be in a much better position to say, oh my word, what were they thinking? Or we're going to say, oh my goodness, they got it, they hit the nail on the head, or we had a really good year because everything came in as forecasted. So I think there's a lot. Obviously, the devil is always in the details.
Always.
It's amazing to me how much interest there is in this budget for all kinds of reasons.
But I think, Teresa, that interest is invited by the Prime Minister's statement. The assertions that he made in the House of Assembly, which people watch religiously, invite a level of scrutiny on a budget that may not necessarily always be there. Sometimes the budget passes without really anybody but the press paying attention. Correct. But the PM made a huge deal about projecting a balanced budget for the first time since independence and a surplus for the first time pretty much ever. And my challenge,
modest, by the way, it's a modest surplus. But
all right, so that was our conversation, mine and Therese, and we started that part of the conversation really talking about energy reform, but she went not necessarily off the beaten path, but she followed the thought with clear logic, and each thing was so sensibly connected to the previous thing. But we ended up talking about Barbados and boardwalks and heads of agreements where things don't materialize that have been made huge deals in public conversation, which I believe actually is a parallel to the conversation about this this supposed budget surplus, the projected balanced budget, the projected budget surplus. So so in short, my first question is, what's your overall sort of response to the conversation? Was there anything in particular that stuck out to you?
Yeah, actually, there was a sort of feeling of not naivety, but a purity that was bordering on naivete, where, you know, it basically surrounding the should of government, right? To paraphrase, she said at one point, you know, this is why we elect politicians, to change laws to benefit the people. And I'm like, is it though? Like, one would hope in a utopia that's what the deal is. But, you know, we all know what the reality doesn't quite line up that easily. You know what I mean? And it just, it put me in down the road of inner commentary as I was listening to things about incentives and the multi-layered aspect of actions and activities that people are taking, and, you know, that sort of thing. So I thought it made sense totally on the surface. Well, let me be clear, not just on the surface, but that this idea that what politicians are doing is this thing over here, or the reason that they exist is for this, versus the multi-layered reality of why they actually exist and how that all works, which I know both of you know very well, but I just feel that a fuller truth of how these things work doesn't come up in these conversations a lot. And so that was my overall, not quite critique, but feel for that segment of the conversation, if that makes sense to you.
It does. The problem is you're wrong. But it's okay. I mean, you usually.
Yeah. No, it's been known to happen. It's just that in this case, you are incorrect.
Well, that's fine. I mean, again, as you say, that has been known to happen. it is just not, in fact, happening at the present moment, is all. On the broad point, yes. I think she is 100% correct. That is why, we elect politicians to govern, right? In the minutia of how that governance is executed is where I think your sort of more detail oriented, what did you call it, fuller truth, might be anchored. But
it's not that I'm disagreeing with that's where the deeper, fuller truth issue is, but I also disagree with that's why we do that. For instance, who is this we?
So, okay, if I answer that question, we're
going to go down a rabbit hole and get off track, I think. But suffice it to say that I still do not agree with
Which is fine, Matthew. You don't have to agree with people who are smart, especially when you are yourself.
No. Well, when
so right. much smarter I mean, than the average person. So it's okay. We can agree to disagree. But I want to answer that question so bad. But you're right. If I do, yeah. we will not talk about.
It's a good thing we have a podcast.
Actually, we should do that with somebody who disagrees with both of us. So it would be I think it'd be a great conversation to have with, you know, over a drink with somebody who has thought about these things as deeply as we have. Okay. So yes. But I think that is almost a side point for the purposes of the conversation we're trying to have today.
Sure.
About the way, so her overall take was that there is talk of policy change,
right,
without really much actual description of how the policy will be changed.
Yeah,
and so how the policy change will,
totally
will be implemented.
And I think she's correct. Well, I don't want to put words in the mouth. To me, that points towards a deeper lack of overall cohesiveness into like what this budget is as opposed to what it's presented to be. I don't think it's portraying any deep, solid, well thought out structural policy decisions.
And is that, I mean, the point that I made to her was that a budget is generally an aspirational document, a budget presentation anyway. And she makes the point that we won't really be able to judge this budget until next year, right? After things have shaken. No, I mean, yeah, that turns out to be the truth in this instance. But even in a non-election year, a budget presentation is aspirational, right? This is what we intend to do. This is what we project our outturn will be. This is what we project our income will be. This is what we project our debt, yada, yada, yada. And then after the fiscal year ends on June 30th, that's when the numbers get crunched and we find out what really happened. Which is why the mid-year budget presentation in March is generally so important, but of course people don't really pay attention to it. So, I don't want to take the space from your thoughts and your reactions though. But I did want to point out that she did make that point, and I wondered whether you thought that there was anything to that.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. Which particular point?
I was following up on your saying that you totally agree about the lack of flesh on the bone.
Oh, the policy. Yeah. I mean, for instance, right? I think this ties into what she later starts to say about Barbados, and in particular, the solar water heaters, right? Which just a year, maybe two before that, I had actually visited, and the same thing popped out at me. I was like, look at all of these solar water heaters. I did not know, that was great information that she dropped, that they actually manufacture them there. And it made me look up the company. And that the technology as they are implementing is something that could be manufactured here. But again, because of the lack of clear policy and policy implementation, should it even become policy, because we could talk about some quote unquote policies that are on the books and have never been enacted. you know, the incentives are not there for a manufacturer, even though this economy is, as she said, slightly larger than Barbados, to go ahead and make those solar water heaters, which would take a huge burden off of the, at least the residential area. And even, well, again, tourism, hot water, big part of your energy costs, right? But there's no incentives in place to take that burden off of the electricity grid. And, you know, maybe I'm not privy to all of the physical plant engineering for all of the hotels. Maybe some of them use boilers or, you know, but the point is it could be here. It's not here because there's no actual policy, in my view, underlying that. And if there is a stated policy, it's certainly not a supported policy.
I don't know if you remember the I Group. It was a Mayaguana-based foreign direct investment project that was originally signed under the first Christie administration in 2006. And it got kicked. Well, it went through the development process, both. So that administration and the Ingram administration changed the direction of the agreement. And then the subsequent Christie administration came back again to try to do something with it. But one of the things that was important about the development was that it was, I mean, tremendous amount of land in Mayaguana. I mean, it was a $1.8 billion project. But one of the things that got very prominent in the conversation about the I Group and that project was the fact that since it's so much land, and since they were building, you know, they were supposed to build an airport, they were supposed to build a marina, a boutique hotel, they were supposed to do a high-end luxury resort and then some manufacturing, right? And as usual, this heads of agreement made tremendous news. It was a splash. It was all over the place. And as usual, this is now nearly 20 years later, and not a thing, aside from some initial, I guess, good faith construction in Mayaguana that never went anywhere. Right? This is what happens to us. A promise is made. We accept that promise as being made in good faith. Time passes. The focus shifts to something else. And we are left looking at the undeveloped I Group property in Mayaguana, the undeveloped Gin Group property in Grand Bahama. You know what I'm saying? It's like these projects are the way we do national development and planning just doesn't seem to make any sense when you look at the reality 20 years down the road.
And by their deeds, you shall know them.
Yeah. And I think that was why I was so agitated when she talked about the fact that, in her view, if Barbados can do it, we can do it. Because the difference is stark. Barbados implemented a policy and executed the policy that was implemented. And you don't have to ask or guess because the solar water heaters are there. They're being manufactured and they are mandatory in these developments. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is not a question of whether or not there is a policy. The policy is living and breathing and doing something. So I suppose as a matter of native and innate potential, if Barbados can do it, we can do it.
See, now you're speaking my language, right? Because I think I've mentioned it on this podcast before. I have a distaste for the word talent, right? And this connects. It's because to me, it's too vague and it assumes too much, right? In reality, to me, what there is what is your actual skill level and what is the potential for your ultimate skill level? So people who are quote unquote talented, in my view, they have a lot of potential, but they still have to go through the process of developing their skill. So if there is the potential for us to have a policy or the results of a policy, right? But we never develop the skill set to implement it, right? Which is what is obviously lacking. Now, is that, how structural is that? Is that in the parties? Is that in the government? Is that in the people? The reality is all three and more. And what does one do about it? But I'm completely on board with you here. Yeah, maybe we have the potential, but there's a lot of roadblocks in actually executing on this. And they're not about just resources that are there. They're about institutional resources.
And I think ultimately, so this is my challenge, right? I thought the budget presentation generally was a good one, right? But my problem is, at the beginning of the budget presentation, the Prime Minister made a big deal about what this budget is supposed to mean and what it's supposed to accomplish, right? And the focus of the budget is making life better for Bahamians, making sure Bahamians have access to and are equipped to take advantage of all the opportunities that exist in this economy and in the broader world, which is a brilliant and beautiful thing to say. Teresa and I looked for that in the actual budget, and we didn't see too much of it. So maybe he needs to come back and say, okay, well, when I was talking about this part of my aspirational speech, here are the actual budget allocations that go to fund programs that will actually make that real. You could look on head number 12 under line 47, and here's the number, right? I think he needs to do that because, frankly speaking, But my point to you is, I think our problem is not our systems, because other people have the same systems and they're working. Our problem is us.
Right. See, let me just clarify, right? Those are formal systems, and there is a set of informal systems. For instance, what's the culture, if you want to be really big and vague about it, but what's the mindset of the people going in? How are they selected? What are the pressures that actually mold the people who become party representatives? What's going on in the actual civil service, et cetera, right? So I call those the informal systems. They still exist as systems in my mind.
But I agree with you. But even those come down to people, Matthew. That's my point.
Yeah. Right? How is an individual's mindset developed? It's not in isolation. So while the responsibility may sit with individuals, because that is one of the only, if not the only way to get out of this, right? They didn't get there by themselves. They got there because of the wider environment.
Yeah.
Which is not to excuse it at all. I'm just saying, what we tell people in school, what we tell people in church, what we tell people while we're playing dominoes, right, is important and a part of this, as silly as that may seem to some people. But so But to take this back to what the prime minister claimed, right? Again, okay. That is a very nice thing to say. But we all know why he said it. Yes, we're talking about budgets in general, but this is an election budget in particular. And everybody knows it. So, you know, let's acknowledge the Leviathan in the room.
Okay, so here's the problem. 20 minutes is gone. And you have just handed me a bomb and said, there's the target.
Tune in next time.
So that is what I'm going to have to do. So I'm going to pull it up, Selector.
Cool.
Yes, Matthew, absolutely. But we can't get into that on this pod. That will be our starting place for our next conversation.
I really look forward to it.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, I feel like here's okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'll save all of that for when we finally actually have that conversation next time.
Don't forget it.
No, man. No. Because it's what I think. So whether I remember it in specific or whether it just comes up organically in the conversation, it's what I think. So anyway, you, my brother, are a blessing. I'm glad that we're doing this together. I cannot wait for you to taste this Weller Special Reserve, man.
I am looking forward to that. You also, sir, are a blessing. I'm glad to have met you and that deigned to allow me to become your partner in this. Really enjoy it.
I feel like you are somehow sneaking a dig in there. I can't see it, but I feel like it's there.
You see, okay, this is an indication that I need to curb my regular behavior, because if you're taking that as insincere, then... You know, I need to be more sincere more often with you.
I don't know if that's a thing, Matthew. I don't know if our relationship can survive too much sincerity, you know?
Oh, man.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, God bless, brother. Take care.
All right, bro.
And we'll catch up, I guess, in time for... a week from now for our listeners, but I'll see you before then.
Yeah, man. Ciao.
That's Darovia.
Check it out.